cry, hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence being commanded.
Please be seated. Well, good morning. We have a full house today, and my notes tell me one of the reasons is we have students from Central Wisconsin Christian School here. If that's the case, would they please stand up with their advisor? Oh, very nice. Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here on a program called Court with Class that we operate in conjunction with the State Bar of Wisconsin. So they've had some opportunity to hear about or learn about through reading the cases that will be heard today. If you can come back, students, after our second oral argument of the morning, which should get done about 12 or 12:15, Justice Rebecca Bradley will come out and talk with you a little bit about the way cases get to the Supreme Court. So you want to wave at them, Justice Bradley? Okay, so she will come out and chat with you if you have the time to stay. And anybody else that wants to join in the conversation can certainly do that as well. Okay, so this morning for our first case, we have Husserman versus BBE. Are you prepared to begin? Please do.
May it please the court. My name is Terry Johnson. I have the privilege of...
Excuse me, just a minute. I'm not hearing you. So I don't know if it's the mic, Attorney Johnson, or what, but this room is hard to hear.
I don't usually have that problem. Is that
okay,
better?
That's better, though. Thank you.
My name is Terry Johnson. I have the privilege of appearing before you to represent Daniel Husserman, the petitioner appellant in this case. Mr. Husserman is present in court as well. We believe that this petition for review presents a relatively simple and direct question. That is this: should an applicant for admission to practice of law be barred from the practice of law due to a series of misjudgments not involving any issue of honesty made under the cloud of emotional entanglements at the approximate age of 25 over a period of 3 to 5 months ending about 3 years ago? Because we believe that is essentially what the Board of Bar Examiners recommended be done. We think that is true because if you examine the findings that were made by the Board of Bar Examiners and examine the evidence, two things are apparent. First of all, virtually all of the findings relate to the conduct of Mr. Husserman with regard to the sad, foolish ending and termination of his relationship with Ms. Fish while he was a student at Drake University Law School and shortly thereafter. None of those relate to honesty. And all of the other matters that were raised by the Board of Bar Examiners, while understandable in the gatekeeping role which this court has indicated they have and which they have obviously accepted, are minor in nature. For example, whether Mr. Husserman disclosed an incident when he was 15 years old when he and some other foolish young man damaged a mailbox or not really has in and of itself nothing to do with the practice of law. As a matter of fact, I thought about this on the way out here this morning. If a client had come to me and said, I'm filling out my bar admission and I have a juvenile conviction from an incident where I committed vandalism on a mailbox when I was 15 years old, that's a closed record as a juvenile. Do I have to disclose that on the application? I would probably not know what to tell them.
Except the application does say, counsel, that you're supposed to disclose expunged convictions. Yeah, so it's pretty clear, or adjudications, it's pretty clear that he needed to disclose it.
If I saw the application, I would understand that. But in and of itself, my first reaction would be, those are juvenile records which are not supposed to be used in any way. But again, it was disclosed eventually. It was discussed. It was addressed. In and of itself, it's a very minor matter. So what we're really here to talk about, I think, in the main part, is whether in the context of the prior decisions of this court, the conduct of Mr. Husserman with regard to Ms. Fish, however inappropriate it was, however wrongful it was, however stupid it was, frankly, should bar him from the practice of law. And I would suggest to the court that under the decisions that I think are most relevant, the Ripple, Jarrett, and Nichols decisions, This court should conclude, as it did in those cases, that although the Board of Bar Examiners' concerns about these troubling matters are understandable and appropriate, they should not be considered by this court as a bar to the practice of law by Mr. Hauserman.
Counsel, we're concerned not just with the misconduct, but his response to the misconduct, correct?
I'm not sure what you mean by the response. If you mean the fact that the misconduct was repeated and resulted in his incarceration,
what I mean is this. On page 12 of your brief, you say Hauserman is not making excuses for his irrational behavior with Ms. Fish. He accepts that he made those mistakes and has accepted and completed the consequences and punishments that followed. Now, at one time, Mr. Hauserman indicated he would seek counseling based on his behavior, right?
Correct.
Okay. Has he gotten that counseling?
No, he has not, and he offered an explanation for that at the hearing, which is at least understandable. That he had two explanations. The first was that because he has been unable to only obtain part-time limited employment, has family responsibilities, he has a child he pays support for, he has not been able to afford it. He doesn't have any insurance to cover any of this, and the expense would be substantial.
Don't you think he should do that before applying for readmission?
Well, that was the second point I was going to raise, Justice Kelly, and that is when it came time for this proceeding and he realized there was an issue, he then became concerned that if he undertook the therapy, the counseling at that time, it would look like he was doing it just for this.
And so shouldn't that have counseled that he hold off on the application?
I'm sorry?
Shouldn't that have counseled that he should hold off on the application so that he could do the counseling,
that certainly
allow a reasonable amount of time to pass so that it would not create that impression?
That would certainly be an approach which could have been taken. It would, however, have meant that he would have been, in a sense, voluntarily accepting an even more extended period of time from being licensed to practice law,
right,
based upon the incidents with regard to Ms. Fish.
Based upon his decisions that followed his behavior with Ms. Fish.
I don't think it depends on which category of decisions you're talking about.
Well, I'm talking about the decision not to seek counseling after he said he would.
Mr. Hauserman testified that he had difficulty accepting at first that he needed counseling.
I understand that. But here's what I'm trying to figure out. So he had a difficult time accepting the idea that he needs counseling. And then he decided not to seek counseling. It's expensive. Yes, it is. He's concerned it might be a just-so story if he takes counseling and then applies. But the bottom line is, he said that he would pursue counseling, and then he didn't. And he applied anyway. How are we supposed to interpret that other than he doesn't want to take the steps necessary to address what he did?
First of all, I don't know that it is established anywhere that he needs to take those steps to address what he did. It was recommended by one person that he saw and was evaluated for. I don't think that establishes as a fact that he needs to do that in order to become licensed to practice law.
Let's talk about this then. Also on page 12 of your brief, you say, in assessing the issues with Ms. Fish, the board did not give weight to Hauserman's explanation for his actions, which demonstrated that he was improperly but understandably reacting to a scorned romantic relationship. In what way was his behavior understandable?
Behavior was understandable because, as he testified, although he initially discontinued the relationship with Ms. Fish, after that point in time, she showed to him signs of wanting to rekindle the relationship. The two of them initiated contact with each other for a period of time, I believe between March and May of 2015, if I recall correctly. And during that period of time, he thought that they had resolved some of the issues that had caused them to discontinue the relationship. And as a result, he thought they were going to resume their romantic relationship and even become married. As a result, when she started to take steps to say she didn't want to deal with him anymore, he tended to see it, at least initially, as only another obstacle, such as the one that had caused the relationship to, in his view, temporarily discontinue before.
All right. Also in your brief, you describe his continued contacts with Ms. Fish even after the directives from Drake and the police department to cease communications as an emotional and irrational thinking response. Yeah?
I think that's correct.
Okay. So now with all of that, How are we to evaluate his application for reinstatement after having decided not to pursue counseling? No, it's not necessarily an explicit mandatory requirement that he seek that. But after all of this behavior, and acknowledging at one point at least that he would seek counseling, and then deciding not to, how are we supposed to grant his petition for readmission having done that?
I think there are a couple of reasons. First of all, it has been 3 years since this conduct. We're talking about conduct that occurred, depending on when you conclude it started and ended, whether it starts with the action administratively by the school, or whether it starts by the court order, of a period of 3 to 5 months in a young man's life in which he behaved in an appropriate way and has never claimed otherwise. Second of all, it's now been 3 years, and he has done absolutely nothing wrong. There is nothing suggesting he has ever engaged in any of that kind of behavior before.
Has he encountered another stressful or emotional event similar to what he experienced with Ms. Fish?
I can only speak for how I would react to the events he's gone through, and I would say undeniably so. The denial of the right to practice law because of these issues. I cannot imagine anything more stressful. I can't see him, but if he doesn't look stressful now, it's the first time he hasn't looked stressful since the first day I spoke to him. This is an extremely stressful and difficult proposition for him, and he has handled it very well.
Counsel, can I take you to the actual disclosures that he made when he did disclose? Because we have the fact that this all occurred, and you keep focusing us on the fact this was only 3 to 5 months. But then he did not disclose this information on his bar examination, on his bar admission documents. And when he did talk about it, did so in a way that really didn't accept responsibility. Brittany Fish made a criminal complaint against me. The complaint was based on text messages received from my number and emails received from my email address. I mean, that type of statement really does not accept responsibility, and that was not during those 3 to 5 months that we're talking about here.
I agree that the passive tone could be criticized, and again, if I had been involved in drafting it, I would have told him, you need to be more direct in discussing it. But it is accurate as far as it goes.
But isn't that part of the problem, counsel? It's accurate as far as it goes, but no further. And what we're looking for, this is really disturbing behavior. And what we're looking for is assurance that this is not going to happen again. The practice of law can be a very stressful endeavor, right? And the practice of law requires rationality under pressure. And in your brief, I think accurately, described how he acted irrationally under pressure. And there's been no counseling since then, not even an assessment, to determine what the risk of this would be of reoccurring.
Again, I would suggest that 3 years having gone by without having engaged in any behavior remotely like this is better than an assessment. I've had lots of cases where psychiatrists and psychologists have testified, and after examining the same person, have come up with completely different opinions. So if you're asking me, I'd rather go by conduct than by somebody's opinion.
But I'd rather go by someone's clinical assessment rather than a young man who's motivated to get his license back.
Well, I would suggest that even if it were true that he has only behaved well because he's motivated to get his license back, that would also suggest that he would be strongly motivated to behave well to keep his license. And again, I would point out, if you look at the cases that we've discussed, in those cases, there were far more, in some instances, in Ms. Ripple's case, multiple instances of specific dishonest conduct admitted in some instances by her, in one instance she was convicted of, over a period of years. And she was admitted because this court concluded that she wasn't disqualified morally. If it was my call and I was deciding between somebody who had admitted repeated instances of dishonest conduct, from theft to mysterious disappearance of funds, to discontinuation cooperation in the deferred program, to promising to pay law school tuition, welching on it, and not paying on it, I would rather take the person who, in an emotional situation, a romantic emotional situation, behave badly as someone who can practice law, where I can tell you, romance doesn't come up a whole lot, than somebody who has repeatedly demonstrated.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, not. I have my moments. They're just not in the law office.
All right. Thank you.
I feel like Spencer Tracy already. And guess who's coming to dinner. But then somebody who has demonstrated, as Ms. Ripple did, repeated dishonest conduct, or in the other cases, Mr. Jarrett and Mr. Nichols, people who had deliberately committed falsehoods to advance themselves in the legal profession, one by committing plagiarism, and in the second instance, taking his professional ethical duties so seriously that he didn't bother to go to the professional ethics class and failed it in law school, and the other one who misrepresented on multiple occasions his achievements in law school to get a job. If you were going to ask me which of these three, four candidates carries with him or her the most serious risk of misbehaving in a professional way in the future, I would say Mr. Hauserman is by far the least likely candidate. He hasn't done anything dishonest. They all had issues with what they said on their applications as well, similar to these. They all had minor scrapes with the law, whether they would be traffic tickets or minor issues in the past. But they had basic questions about honesty while they were in law school. And this court concluded, correctly, I think, that although there were reasons for the Board of Bar Examiners to have raised questions about their suitability to practice law, there wasn't a reason to bar them from practicing. Now, in, I think, two of those instances, the court imposed restrictions on their practice of law. I think mentoring in two cases, and in another case there was a second restriction about, I believe, psychological evaluation or something. And Mr. Hauserman has indicated absolutely, particularly if he could get a license to practice law, he has a job he could get, he would be in a better position to not only provide for his child, but pay for therapy. He is more than willing to do this.
One of the things that this case has that the three others that you mentioned did not have, and that is the state of Iowa not allowing him admission to practice law. He graduated from Drake, and the state says, no, you don't meet the character and fitness test, essentially. So if Iowa, explain to me why, if Iowa won't let him in, why should we? And then the second part of this exam is, if we would let him in, should there be conditions? You referenced conditions in the other cases. I well recall those. What conditions should there be? So the first one is, why should we if Iowa wouldn't do it?
Number one, I try not to speak disparagingly about Iowa, and I'll try not to here. I don't know at all what went on in Iowa. I don't know whether there was it appears there was not a proceeding at all comparable to what went on here. There, something happened, and they precluded him from taking the bar exam. The record is just not very clear on that. Second, on that subject, this court has made it clear in each of these decisions in discussing the role of the Board of Bar Examiners and the role of this court that although you very much appreciate the hard work by the Board of Bar Examiners, which they did in this case, and while you certainly take their findings as given, and we accept that in this case, whether we agree with them or not, it is your role to pass judgment on who should be practicing law in this state. I would suggest that also means it's not the state of Iowa's job to decide who should be practicing law in this state. And so I think whether you like it or not, you need to make your own independent judgment about Mr. Hauserman, and particularly in view of the slimness of the record on what examination Iowa actually did. As to the second point, as I think we said in our brief, we think there are two appropriate restrictions. One, which I personally would recommend to anyone getting out of law school, would be to get in a practice situation where they have someone who tells them what to do and what not to do. Like, the idea that I could have gotten out of law school and practiced on my own is almost as frightening to me as it would have been to any reasonable client who would have come to see me. So I think the first thing is Mr. Hauserman should properly be restricted to a situation in which he either is employed by a mentor or has a mentor selected by, as I think has been in the past, the Office of Lawyer Regulation, so that there is somebody who can report on him and is in a position to detect any sign of any kind of misconduct.
For how long?
I'm sorry?
For how long, Mr. Johnson?
I guess I don't have a strong opinion on that.
2 months, 5 months?
No, I think longer than that.
2 years?
I think a six-month period minimum, and if you were to say a year or 2 years, I don't think Mr. Hauserman or I would quarrel with that in any way. He is, if he's going to be practicing law, at least as of the time of the hearing, his intent would have been to join the practice of the lawyer who testified, his part-time employer now, Mr. Gill, who, from at least what I can tell, would be a perfectly appropriate mentor. But again, it's probably best if someone other than Mr. Hauserman or his attorney selected that person. The second thing is, I agree, if Mr. Hauserman had sought advice about how to do this before he filed this application, not because I think the law requires it, because I think it would have been good tactics, he should have gone and gotten an evaluation. And I think the court should condition his being licensed to practice law on receiving an evaluation, whatever course of therapy that evaluation might recommend, and a report to this court, which this court finds satisfactory before licensing him.
It's more, though, than just good tactics, isn't it? Wouldn't it be an expression of an acceptance of responsibility and an understanding that something went wrong and a desire to figure out what it was and to put things into practice that would fix it?
I think the facile response for me to give you would be to say yes. But I think that is superficial, Justice Kelly, because whether it's tactics or a genuine recognition, the answer is the same. And so if he did it, how would you know which it is? It just indicates he's done something either because he thinks it's a good idea, because he was ordered, or because he's afraid you might ask these questions if he doesn't do it.
Yeah,
I just don't know what you could read into that.
Well, perhaps the counseling would have delved into that very question. And we'd have some read on that.
That could be. I could only speculate as to that. But again, in my world, going 3 years without having any problem of any kind whatsoever, particularly given the context of this. I mean, I don't want to say boys will be boys or, you know, anything's fair in love and war or any of this kind of foolishness. But the fact of the matter is, I can almost remember being 25. By the time I was 25, I'd been married for several years, so I wasn't allowed to have
girlfriends. We don't want to go there.
But, I certainly had friends who were 25 years old and were involved in romantic relationships and did stupid things. They didn't do these stupid things. They did stupid things. And I think to take the fact that someone is, at least in some sense, desperate to rekindle and establish a relationship, that they would do things that, in retrospect, make no sense, is not a hard concept to accept.
Well, the concept might not be hard, but the extent here to which he violated repeated orders is really the concern. It's not that he wanted to rekindle, and it's the fact that he was ordered from Drake University more than once, he was ordered from the police, and then there was a court order, and then he was in violation of that order with guns in his house, which is a violation that he could have been prosecuted for in and of itself. So, I mean, that's the concern here. It's not the initial conduct necessarily that maybe he wanted to rekindle a relationship. It's repeated lack of disregard for the rules and the law. And this is someone who wants to practice law. So, I mean, shouldn't that be of concern to us, the extent to which he disregarded the law?
Well, I think we need to put those in context. First of all, I'm not sure. I don't do school law. I'm not sure how one should view a directive from Drake University not to behave in a certain way. I mean, it's not the law. It's a student policy situation, number one. Number two, when he did violate it and he was restricted, he obeyed it. And he obeyed it to the letter for a period of the period that lapsed from the time the order that said he should not have any more contact with the second order until he graduated. So he did show, albeit for a fairly short period of time, willingness to comply with that. The police directive not to have contact with her, I'm sorry, it's like the signs when you make a curve that says, go 45 miles around the curve. It's advisory. It's not the law. The police have no authority in and of themselves.
How about the court order?
The court order is a problem, no question. And he did a stupid, wrong thing for which he has been punished heavily. He's done time in jail. He was put on probation. He satisfactorily completed those terms. He lost the right to be practice law in Iowa, apparently permanently. His right to practice law in this state has been deferred already substantially, far longer than I suspect he would have been suspended if he had been a practicing attorney and had done all the same things, and I realize the court views those as different things, but the situation is not completely different. So it's not like he hasn't been punished and had an opportunity to learn his lesson.
I see my yellow light is on. Mr. Johnson, what do you want this court to do?
I'm sorry?
What do you want this court to do?
I want this court to direct, as it did in the other three cases, that the Board of Bar Examiners issue whatever certificate or order it issues in ordinary cases, certifying that he meets the good character requirements, and impose on his ability to practice law for whatever period of time it deems appropriate the restrictions we talked about. Require him to go through an evaluation and any therapy ordered by a professional. If there is any requirement, we don't know that there will be any requirement. And second of all, require him to be in a mentoring or supervisory situation with a licensed lawyer for at least a period of 6 months, longer if you think that's appropriate.
The BBE, according to a note I have, considered a conditional admission under 40.075 and rejected it, explaining the conditional admission was not designed to address applicants who exhibit a lack of candor and or credibility for admission.
All I can say is I can point to the decisions this court made and the cases I cited in which that kind of condition was imposed. The BBE had exactly the same concerns in those cases. This court disagreed and imposed conditions. I think the court should do the same thing here.
Jared Nichols.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Thank you for the opportunity this morning to speak to you about the Board of Bar Examiners and how it views the Hauserman matter. And I want to begin by recounting, because I think they're very significant, the facts in this case. A little over 3 years ago, while he was in his final semester of law school in Iowa at Drake University, and for several months following his law school graduation, Daniel J. Hauserman engaged in conduct that was not only deeply disturbing, but also criminal. Beginning in March of 2015, he began a succession of unwanted communications with a Drake University undergraduate student named Brittany Fish. He was first warned in writing by Drake University officials on March 9, 2015, to cease having contact with her. That letter made it clear that he was not to have any contact in any form with her. That same letter directed him not to have any communication with known friends or associates of her in an attempt to communicate with Ms. Fish. Despite those directives, that very same day and again on the following day, Mr. Hauserman sent Ms. Fish unwanted email messages. 2 weeks later, he made phone contact with her and sent her three more email messages the next day. Ms. Fish, in response, filed a second complaint with the university. University officials met with Mr. Hauserman and sent him a letter on April 2nd, once again advising him to have no contact with Ms. Fish and further directing him to remain off campus except for the law school. Within 2 weeks of that meeting, however, and receiving that letter, Mr. Hauserman again contacted Ms. Fish via email. He began that email with the following, quote, "I am aware this is in violation of the no communication / contact order and places me at risk of certain arrest," end quote. 2 days later, he sent a text message to Ms. Fish's mother in which he sought to, quote, "shed some light on the situation with her daughter." After becoming aware of those additional contacts, university officials advised Mr. Hauserman in writing on April 29th that he was prohibited from being anywhere on the Drake University campus except for completing his final exams. The letter further advised that following his law school commencement on May 15th, he would be barred indefinitely from being anywhere on the Drake campus. Nevertheless, one day after his law school graduation, he contacted Ms. Fish by telephone, leaving her a voicemail message, which she reported to the Des Moines Police Department. In turn, the police contacted Mr. Hauserman twice by phone and warned him not to have any further contact with Ms. Fish in any way, including by phone, text, email, or social media. He was told by the police that violating that directive would result in a charge of harassment in the third degree. Mr. Hauserman told the police he understood that warning. 7 days later, and despite that police warning and his own acknowledgement that he was not to contact Ms. Fish, he sent her four more text messages, which began the evening of May 27th and concluded in the early morning hours of May 28th. In response, Ms. Fish called the Des Moines Police Department to report them. Those post-graduation contacts ultimately led to him being charged with harassment in the third degree, which in turn led to his deferred prosecution agreement. Approximately 2 weeks later, Mr. Hauserman met with the Iowa Board of Law Examiners to address the issues arising out of his bar application, of which the unwanted communications with Ms. Fish were foremost in their minds. He explained to the Iowa Board that he had contacted Ms. Fish following his graduation from Drake University because Drake no longer had jurisdiction over him and because Ms. Fish had failed to appear at his graduation as she had promised. Asked when Ms. Fish had made that promise, Mr. Hauserman said March. He later conceded that given the intervening events, including the harassment complaints, the no-contact order, the trespass sanctions, perhaps circumstances had changed and she was no longer interested in attending his graduation. The Iowa Board determined that based on his conduct, both before and immediately after his graduation from law school, he did not possess the necessary character and fitness to be eligible to sit for the Iowa bar exam. The Iowa Board did not believe that he had shown remorse for his conduct, and they further believed that his course of conduct with Ms. Fish had not yet come to an end. He was advised that he could reapply in Iowa only after demonstrating that his harassment of Ms. Fish was done and that it would be helpful to have an evaluation conducted by a therapist confirming his acceptance of that. The Iowa Board's decision was particularly prescient because 2.5 months later, in September of 2015, Mr. Hauserman entered a stipulation acknowledging that he had willfully violated the no-contact order by having contact with Ms. Fish and by possessing four firearms, two of which were found loaded in his apartment. His deferred prosecution agreement was therefore revoked, and he was found guilty of harassment in the third degree. He was given a one-year suspended jail sentence, placed on probation for 1 year, and ordered to complete a mental health evaluation. In November, he underwent that court-ordered psychological evaluation, which indicated that he held little, if any, empathy for the impact his actions had on the victim, and that he believed the consequences of his actions were overblown and undeserved. The psychologist recommended that he undergo a behavioral intervention to address his impulsivity and poor problem solving. He was also recommended to undergo individual therapy. To date, Mr. Hauserman has not undergone any psychological treatment before or since his conviction. When asked by the board why he had not engaged in any such treatment, Mr. Hauserman replied, quote, "It would seem like I was just doing what you wanted me to do or what I thought you wanted me to do," end quote. But his attitude was quite different in his September 26, 2017 letter to the board, wherein he acknowledged, quote, "that professional guidance in my mental health would be pertinent as recommended," and that he wanted to face his deficiency head on to work toward a more cognizant, empathic self. Yet during the ensuing 4 months, between the time he submitted that letter and his hearing before the board, Mr. Hauserman sought no therapy or assistance of any kind, calling into question both his sincerity and his credibility. In his initial application before the board, Mr. Hauserman did not reveal any of his misconduct involving Ms. Fish. His subsequent applications disclosed his involvement, but only to a minimal degree. For instance, when asked to explain what his conviction for harassment entailed, he explained, "Brittany Fish made a complaint against me. The complaint was based on text messages received from my number and emails received from my address." While technically true, that explanation certainly minimizes the extent of what occurred. Mr. Hauserman appears to have little to no insight as to how his actions have affected Ms. Fish, and he was unable to provide any meaningful explanation as to why his conduct continued for such an extended period of time, especially after being sanctioned for it repeatedly, including spending time in jail. Mr. Hauserman offered no evidence to suggest that he is not at risk to reengage in similar behavior at some point in the future, and demonstrated little remorse for his conduct. The board found his lack of insight into his conduct to be disturbing and did not find him to be credible or convincing. Other than working part-time as a law clerk, Mr. Hauserman has not demonstrated any evidence of significant rehabilitation. He has not availed himself of individual or group therapy, despite recommendations to that effect. He has not become involved with the Wisconsin Lawyers Assistance Program. Indeed, he has not done anything that would suggest he is interested in making amends for his misconduct or in improving himself, and thus has shown no meaningful signs of improvement or rehabilitation. And while certainly more remote in time than the other events that have been previously discussed, the board did also find it troubling that he failed to disclose to bar officials in Wisconsin and in Iowa the incident from 2003 in which he was involved in the destruction of a mailbox. His explanation for failing to twice make that disclosure is specious, especially since he made a very plain disclosure about that to his law school and could easily have obtained that record to accurately report it both in Wisconsin and Iowa. The board did not find his explanations for failing to include that information to be credible, convincing, or compelling, especially after he had disclosed it to his law school. Mr. Hauserman had two other concerning police interactions, one in 2007 and the other in 2012. Each involved admittedly minor incidents, one related to underage drinking and the other related to a traffic stop. In both instances, however, he evinced an attitude towards law enforcement officials that suggests a pattern of problematic behavior in which Mr. Hauserman does not believe that certain rules and requirements apply to him or that he should accept responsibility for his actions. That attitude was also reflected in Mr. Hauserman's hearing before the board, namely that someone other than he is to blame for the trouble in which he finds himself. Rather than accepting responsibility for his actions, he deflects it onto others, thereby minimizing the role he played in each incident. He has displayed a consistent pattern evading responsibility for his own conduct. His explanations about the omissions on his bar application, especially his conduct involving Ms. Fish, as well as the incident involving the mailbox, were neither compelling nor convincing. His credibility is therefore wanting, and his disregard for the rule of law questionable. By knowingly and repeatedly violating the terms of his deferred prosecution, and by failing to make any meaningful steps towards his own rehabilitation, he has not shown that he possesses the necessary character and fitness that is essential for admission to the Wisconsin bar. Likewise, his character and fitness is further undermined because he has failed to meet his burden of establishing his honesty, diligence, or reliability, all of which are essential characteristics for attorneys in Wisconsin. When considered as a whole, therefore, the board concluded that Mr. Hauserman failed to establish the requisite character and fitness for admission. All applicants to the bar, including those who are admitted with conditions, must meet the requisite character and fitness requirements in order to be admitted. However, conditional admission was not designed to address applicants who exhibit a lack of candor and/or credibility for admission. In this case, the board determined that Mr. Hauserman lacked the necessary character and fitness requirements for admission. Because those essential components were lacking, And since Mr. Hauserman didn't have that critical component, the board did not extend an offer of conditional admission to him. Over the years, this court has considered several different bar admissions matters. Broadly speaking, those matters fall into three categories. In the first category, the court has upheld matters in which the board determined that an applicant should not be certified for admission. The second category includes applicants whose conduct the court found to be troubling, but not sufficiently so to preclude them from admission. In those cases, the court ultimately certified them for admission, often citing a variety of reasons for determining that the applicant had demonstrated the necessary character and fitness to practice law in Wisconsin, including, for instance, that the applicant had undergone treatment or had engaged in extensive community service or had glowing testimonials from employers, or where considerable amount of time had elapsed since the applicant had engaged in the concerning conduct, or a combination of those factors, all of which demonstrated to the court that the applicant had been rehabilitated such that his or her admission was in fact warranted. In cases in which the court granted admission, applicants were found to have a dearth of reported problems, or their conduct could be chalked up to youthful excesses. Here, it cannot be said that Mr. Hauserman has had a dearth of reported problems, nor can his actions be fairly characterized as youthful excesses. On the contrary, his behavior was recent, repeated, and frankly repugnant. In the third category of cases, this court has found that an applicant's behavior, while certainly troubling, was nevertheless sufficiently offset by positive character evidence such that admission was warranted, albeit conditioned by terms uniquely fashioned and determined by this court. While it is within the court's prerogative to impose unique conditions upon applicants for admission to the bar when warranted, it remains outside the scope of the board's authority to do so. Short of the conditions specifically delineated in Supreme Court Rule 40.075, only the court retains the express authority to determine when there are special circumstances under which other types of conditions may be imposed upon an applicant to the bar. Given the seriousness of this case, it is the board's belief that Mr. Hauserman should not be granted admission and that the board's decision to not certify him for admission should be upheld. Similarly, the board does not believe that this is a case in which the court should admit him even with the imposition of special conditions. This is a case which plainly illustrates conduct that is of sufficient gravity to warrant the denial of admission. On multiple occasions, Mr. Hauserman flouted increasing levels of authority while receiving escalating sanctions, first from his law school, next from the police, then from the Iowa Board of Bar Examiners, followed by the Iowa criminal justice system, including its courts.
Counsel, Mr. Hauserman suggests that his behavior is understandable because he was in the grip of romantic impulses with respect to Ms. Fish. That relationship is not likely to reassert itself, or attempted relationship. It's been 3 years since that behavior had concluded. Is that something that we should weigh just as heavily as if it had just occurred? Does that weight decline over time? At what point, and if so, at what point would it be reasonable to say that was a discrete event that occurred in the past with little chance of recurrence?
Well, as you pointed out earlier, Justice Kelly, Mr. Hauserman has done nothing in the interim to address that underlying conduct. And the only thing I can say in response is that past conduct is often a predictor of future conduct. So I do not know whether or not he's been involved or engaged in another relationship since that time. So I don't know what he may or may not do, but it is of sufficient concern and has gone unaddressed, excuse me, such that I do think that it remains a serious matter.
Help us out as a follow-up to Justice Kelly's question. You had indicated that in Iowa they said no go,
that the Iowa board indicated that he showed no signs of remorse or rehab, and but they also indicated, essentially, if he could show that his relationship no longer with this woman no longer was the subject of harassment, number one, and number two, that he got treatment to address his lack of insight, etc., that they would consider a reapplication. As a follow-up to Justice Kelly's question, what touchstones, if any, should this court give for considering a reapplication?
Justice Bradley, the board stands by its position that he should not be admitted, but should the court take the approach that he should be allowed at some point in the future to reapply, minimally it would seem to me that he would have to undergo an evaluation and abide by whatever the recommendations that follow from it are.
You indicated that in our decisions of the relevant cases cited, when we addressed what we could well consider problematic behavior, but nevertheless allowed admission and then set some conditions. Those conditions included treatment. We took notice of community service. At least one, if not more than one of those cases, had glowing recommendations from employers and others involved, including from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and a sufficient amount of time. Are those the kinds of things that we should consider if this court would deny the application now, or allowing as touchstones future application?
I do think that those are relevant matters to consider in deciding whether or not to admit him, as those are things that the court has considered, as you note, in other past cases. The board has determined that Mr. Hauserman's conduct was calculated and deliberate. His statements and explanations about his harassment of Ms. Fish were given due consideration, but were not found to be credible or persuasive. Even his character witnesses, while under cross-examination, appeared not to fully be aware of or informed about the many incidents which were of concern to the board. Mr. Hauserman's conduct demonstrates that he does not adhere well to boundaries or to limits. If admitted, the reality is that Mr. Hauserman would be in a position to represent clients, many of whom could be vulnerable, victims of domestic abuse, those undergoing divorce, or involved in child custody disputes, as well as a host of many other possibilities. Unless and until he can demonstrate consistent adherence to boundaries and limits, he poses too great a risk to be allowed into the practice of law in this state. Furthermore, in the absence of any evidence of rehabilitation, be it some therapy or other form of treatment to address his conduct, it remains unclear whether he is at risk for behaving in a similar manner with clients or others. After all, he has no record of engaging in extensive community service or receiving glowing testimonials from multiple employers. Ultimately, the applicant bears the burden of establishing that he or she has met the character and fitness requirements for admission. Among those requirements,
how do you think he can do that? How do you think the applicant can establish what you want established in order to admit him?
I'm sorry, did you ask, would you repeat the question, please?
Yes. I want to know what kind of record has to be made here by the applicant in order for the applicant to pass muster.
Well, I think minimally he has to address the underlying conduct.
How does he do that?
Well, one of the ways in which he could have done that was to undergo treatment or therapy, as he indicated that he was going to do but decided not to do for reasons that remain unclear. He could certainly be engaged in community service. He could certainly become employed.
That can be just window dressing.
Pardon me?
That can be window dressing. Makes you feel better, but I don't know that it does anything for his ability to practice law.
Depending on the nature of his community service, certainly it may or may not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What else can he do? I mean, as I understand it, you want the court to say, no, Mr. Hauserman, you're not going to be admitted today. You might be admitted in the future. Shall we say that?
Correct.
And in order to be admitted in the future, here's what you should do. I mean, I think that if we say, well, apply again, he has a right. I don't know if he has a right. But I think it's fair for him to say, okay, I'll do whatever you want. Tell me what you want me to do, and I'll do it. So what should we tell him to do?
Well, I might argue that... Pardon?
Concrete things he should do.
Well, as I've indicated previously, one of the things in which he could do is engage in therapy and or treatment. He could certainly, again, he could become employed in some capacity to show that he can reliably work with others. He could certainly do that also in a community volunteer setting.
Okay.
But again, the applicant is the one who bears the burden to demonstrate his or her character and fitness for admission.
Oh, I agree with that. But I think it's fair for the board or government here to say what he has to do or what things he can do to show that.
Certainly certainly staying out of any further trouble would be
good idea.
A good idea as well, yes.
Counsel, isn't the answer that he should engage in behavior that would demonstrate to us that he has a good character?
Absolutely.
And that we can't prescribe that, because in the act of prescribing, we are depriving whatever actions those might be of having any indicative value of what his character is.
Right. I think you could certainly make that argument, yes.
Well, I'd make the argument, you ought to tell me something, then I'll try and do it. This way I'm just going blind on this. And you could just say, no, I do it. And then you say, oh, not good enough again. I mean, it seems to me that it's fair to tell the applicant what this applicant might do in considering the applicant's record to establish admission to the bar.
I think that's fair enough, but at the same time, it's hard to understand how the board should address his continued and reckless flouting of authority. I don't know how to address that.
Mm-hmm.
I truly do not. And he did it not only to the police, he did it to the Iowa board, he did it with the court system. And he did all of that at a point in time when he had graduated from law school and, to the board's mind, certainly should have known better than that.
Science tells us that the male brain is not developed until age 28 or 29.
Amen.
Oh, yes. I guess I won't say anything further. I'm not saying that the science is always right. I want to make sure these students understand that, and no offense to the male students or non-students here. I'm just repeating science.
Of which I should point out, my son is among them, so he's listening. The record is clear that Mr. Hauserman's conduct is disturbing and serious, both because of what he actually did and because he did not seem to care that he did it. His misdeeds have not been offset by any meaningful rehabilitative efforts. When coupled with his lack of disclosure and the other incidents of misconduct, it becomes apparent that he does not possess the requisite character and fitness to be certified for admission. Mr. Hauserman has not established that he has the requisite character and fitness to practice law in the state because he has not demonstrated that he possesses those essential qualities. He should be barred from engaging in the practice of law in Wisconsin. I therefore respectfully request that the board's decision to deny certifying for admission be upheld. Thank you.
Should we tell him not to apply for another year?
I think certainly it's within the court's prerogative to determine a time frame during which he should sit out, if that's what the court decides, before being able to reapply.
Have we done that in any case?
The most recent ones, I do not recall a specific time frame, although ones beyond that perhaps so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As I listened to Ms. Rothstein's presentation, two things struck me. The first is, like many advocates, some of the things she said the board found go considerably beyond what the board actually found. For example, there's no finding that he calculatedly decided to violate these provisions. And I would just encourage you to read the findings of the board against her presentation, because like all of us, she strayed into advocacy that I think goes beyond the findings.
Counsel, you suggested that Mr. Hauserman would be motivated strongly to adhere to his ethical obligations out of fear of potentially losing a license if we were to allow him admission. And yet the fear of a criminal conviction was not enough to dissuade his behavior. So why should we conclude that this would be a sufficient deterrent?
Two things, I guess, Justice Kelly. Number one, going back to a question you raised and that Justice Abramson raised, is how does an applicant demonstrate that they have learned their lesson, that they have shown good moral character? Again, I would suggest the living experience shows that. I can't point to a specific instance in which Mr. Hauserman could have been tempted to violate the law or violate some court order again, but the fact of the matter is it has been 3+ years since this conduct. It took him longer than it should have to learn his lesson, but it appears he learned it. Second, I guess I don't have a good answer to the other part of your question, and that's the problem here. What I can point out is a couple of things. Number one, unlike these other cases that we cited, and I can't address Justice Abramson's comment about how long you've required applicants to wait and other decisions when they've been denied, understandably, I looked at the cases where you granted people the right to practice. But in the cases where you granted people the right to practice, you did that in the face of very recent evidence of conduct involving dishonesty. There is no evidence of dishonesty here. There's no evidence of any threats. I'm not in any way minimizing the conduct of Mr. Hauserman with regard to Ms. Fish, but he never threatened her. He had the guns. That was a stupid violation of the conditions, and he was punished for it, and he has accepted it. But there's no evidence at all that she felt threatened or any of this. What the board has suggested here is just out of the record. What the record shows is somebody who couldn't accept the fact that although there were some indirect indications that maybe she still wanted to talk to him, comments through internet and so on, that it really was over and didn't accept it. And a lot of us would have figured it out the first time she went to the university or when she went to the police. It took him longer. But he obviously figured it out. It's been 3+ years. He hasn't bothered her. The blemish on his record is that he couldn't stop calling Ms. Fish. And he couldn't stop texting Ms. Fish because of how he felt about her. And that got him in a world of trouble and has deprived him of the right to practice law for an extended period of time that he would have otherwise had. It appears he learned that lesson. He stopped contacting Ms. Fish. if he had never contacted Ms. Fish, would we be having this discussion?
I think we would be concerned about whether there might be a future Ms. Fish with a different name, Counselor. And I think that's what a lot of the questions go to. His lack of recognition of the effect that his conduct had on this woman is what is of concern.
I don't think that's a fair characterization of the record, and I would encourage you to read his answer about it, in which he said he understands that this was capable of causing her harm, it was capable of causing her emotional distress. He shouldn't have done it, and he's remorseful for it. But again, we're not talking about whether he should be on probation or go to jail. We're talking about whether he should be practicing law. And where is the indication that there's ever going to be a Ms. Fish in the practice of law? If there is a risk of him behaving like this toward a Ms. Fish, is it any greater whether he's licensed to practice law or not?
Counsel, is it reasonable for us to expect that having exhibited this kind of behavior, that in order to gain admission, he would do something more than meet the minimum expectations we have for everyone? Don't commit a crime. Don't harass a woman. Isn't it reasonable for us to expect something affirmative from him, establishing his character?
I don't know what that would be, Justice Scalia.
Isn't that his responsibility to figure out?
Let's take one of the examples. You can go and do community service. Some of the most disgusting people I've ever known have gone out and done community service. I mean, how does that prove anything other than I did it?
It might not. It might be something else. But isn't that his responsibility to figure out?
I don't know what he can do to demonstrate that he learned his lesson about Ms. Fish other than, number one, not contacting Ms. Fish, which he's managed to do for over 3 years, and number two, not doing anything like it again. Short of that, I don't know what you can expect of him. I recognize that, as you've already pointed out, the issue with not going in to see the therapist is a problem. I think it can be dealt with by a conditional admission, and I think there's an explanation for it. But if there's something that is a concern here, that would be the only thing I can identify.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, these cases are always difficult. They're difficult for counsel, and they're difficult for the applicant to the bar, and we understand that. We are now going to take a brief recess. I don't know if you students are staying for the next argument. You certainly are welcome to do so, or whether we have another group coming in. But in any case, we will adjourn now for a few minutes while we get set up for our next argument of the morning. We are adjourned.